Welcome here. My name is Joel Thiessen. I'm an associate professor of sociology here at Ambrose. I've just finished my seventh year here at Ambrose, just coming off a year-long sabbatical. And I study religion, specifically religion and culture in Canada. So that's the kinds of things that I think about, the kinds of things that I write about. And so I want to share a little bit today about religion and young people and young adults and what we can understand about them, what that means for the local church, etc. A bit of contextual information, a few things that I'll draw to your attention, things that I've written, and I've got some handouts there if you want, either as you come in or as you're on your way out. The first is a book that I co-author titled The Sociology of Religion, A Canadian Perspective. This is essentially a sociology of religion textbook, which is not going to be of much interest for yourselves until you get to the last three chapters, where we actually deal with all of the current Canadian context and data and examples, and there's a lengthy section on young people, etc. I think it's important for a couple of reasons within this context. First of all, it's Canadian. Most of the data that we have on young people tends to come out of the United States, most within this particular denomination of how we think about religious and cultural trends come out of the United States. Nothing inherently wrong about that, but we are in Canada, and so I think it's important to have a Canadian understanding. So this seeks to shed some light on what are the cultural and religious trends in Canada, how do we frame that within the ways in which societies are changing in a globalized and late modern era, etc. So there's a sheet on that here. The second, I'm going to borrow this from you, Mark, is a book of mine that's coming out this November. It was one of the primary tasks of mine during sabbatical, titled The Meaning of Sunday, The Practice of Belief in a Secular Age. This sheet gives you a bit of an overview of the book, gives you an advanced discount before the book actually comes out. Super affordable, super accessible. The general thrust of this book is based on interviews with three groups of Canadians. The first are individuals who identify with a Christian group and attend religious services on a nearly weekly basis. The second group are those individuals who identify as part of a Christian group and attend religious services mainly for religious holidays and rites of passage. They show up every Christmas, they show up every Easter, they want to get married in your church, they want their child baptized, but they never attend any other point throughout the year. And then finally are individuals who say they have no religion and never attend religious services, which is the fastest growing quote-unquote religious group in Canada, the United States, and the modern Western world today. Represent about 1 in 4 Canadians today. So this book seeks to explain what explains higher and lower levels of religious involvement. In what ways are these groups similar? In what ways are they dissimilar? And so I'm going to draw a little bit on material from that book, as well as the first one, and talking about some of these things. And I'll bring in a whole series of other studies that have been done to get us thinking about the state of religion and culture in Canada when it comes to young adults. We're here live and in person. I want to engage in dialogue with you. I'll talk a little bit. We'll have a fair bit of time for question and answer. Feel free to interject at any point if you have questions. If you want to push back, you don't have to agree with everything I say. I'm totally fine with that. We can have a discussion. But I'm also pretty active on social media. So on my website, I blog a fair bit about all kinds of things related to the church and religion in Canada. So you can check some things out on the website. I tweet fairly regularly. So if that's your thing and you're into that, then you can follow me on Twitter and other ways of reaching me as well. All right, three specific questions that I want to tackle during our time together today. The first, what are the cultural, social, familial, and congregational influences that shape and reflect young people's approach to Christianity? One of the first assumptions in sociology is that we are very much shaped by our social surroundings. People view themselves and others, and I would say their faith, differently based on the cultural context they're in. Not just the country that they're part of, but the specific congregation, specific city, family, etc. that they're part of. So I want to look at what are some of those cultural and social, etc. factors that reflect young people's approach to Christianity. Second, what are the implications and what might implications be for these trends for the current and future state of Christian denominations and congregations? I would suggest that denominations and congregations that are in tune with reality of what's going on today and the potential future will have a keen eye towards what is taking place among young people. And I'll say more about that in a moment. And then finally, what are the sociological, theological, and practical implications to arise from this data? While I'm a sociologist of religion, I spend most of my time reading and thinking about things in the domain of sociology of religion. I'm also actively part of a local church. I've served on a church board for 4 years, chaired our board for a couple of years. And so as I think about the practical and theological implications, I'm not just thinking as a sociologist of religion. I'm thinking as someone who's a practitioner within a local church and trying to think about how these worlds come together. And so I want to offer some different reflections there and certainly engage in some ideas that you might have based on the things that that we'll talk about today. So, to begin, if you want to understand the future of Christianity, of a particular denomination, of a congregation, if you want to understand where you will be in 5, 10, 15, 20 years from now, you look to the current state of your young people. One of the things that we know sociologically is that it is incredibly rare for people to take on religious faith later on in life. It doesn't mean that it doesn't happen. I'm sure we could all think of anecdotal stories of people who have come to faith later on in life. But study after study after study worldwide across religious traditions show that people who are actively involved and engaged as children and teenagers is the most significant catalyst of whether or not they may or may not be involved later on in life. It doesn't mean if they are religious as teenagers that they guaranteed will be religious as adults, but the chances of that happening are significantly increased if that is the case. So with that assumption, I want to look at some of the data here in Canada and the context that is set before us. Here you see two comparisons. This comes from Reginald Bibby, who's one of the leading sociologists of religion in Canada, in his latest book titled Beyond the Gods and Back. Here he compares different levels of religiosity, of attendance, those who attend weekly versus those who never attend, those who identify with a religion, whether they do or do not, and then those who believe in a god or those who do not believe in a god. And he compares both adults and teenagers over the course of time. And one of the things we do sociologically is try to track trends over time to see are things increasing, decreasing, and what are some of the contributing factors to those realities. I'm not as interested in adults, but I'll just briefly highlight. When you look at adults, for every indicator on the highly religious end of the continuum, that is those who attend weekly, those who affiliate with a religious tradition, and those who claim to believe in a god, for each of those indicators, all of those indicators have moved in a downward direction. So if you look from 75 to 2005, you'll see a 6% decline of weekly attenders and so forth. Conversely, on the non-religious end of the continuum, for adults, you will find that there has been marginal increases there. So among those who never attend from 1975 to 2005, you see an increase and so forth. These are not significant decreases or increases, but it's a bit of an indicator, a thermometer of what's going on. However, when you look to teenagers, these trends are far more pronounced, and I would suggest far more indicative of where we can expect the state of Christianity and religion, broadly speaking, to be within Canadian context. And so here, among those who attend weekly, those who identify, and those who categorically believe in a god, these have all decreased. Most notably, among those who identify with a religion, you see this decline from 88 to 68% between 84 and 2008. And you see those who are theists, those who categorically say that they believe in God, declining from 54 to 37%. Conversely, on the non-religious end of the continuum, you'll find far more significant increases among teenagers. So here you see an increase from 28 to 47% of those who never attend religious services. That is, one in two Canadian teenagers today never attend religious services. If we want to think practically and theologically about the implications, one might ask, what does it mean for the local church, mindful that today one in two teenagers never attend religious services? What are the outworkings of that for how we do ministry, how we think about the local church and our engagement within society at large? If we move further down, we look at identification, you find that one-third of Canadian teens, 32%, say that they do not identify with any religion. So this is not just Christianity, this is any religion at all. And then finally, among atheists, you see an increase from 6 to 16%. I don't show these statistics to alarm us, to raise the red flag, so to speak, but just to give us a realistic dose. We are not living in the same era as my parents or grandparents or great-grandparents in terms of young people's even affinity with Christian belief and practice. And because of that, we ought to think very carefully about how we seek to engage young people in the Canadian context. Now, in the United States, the same kinds of trends are occurring. They are not as rapid as what we're seeing in Canada. They have not reached the levels that we're seeing in Canada, but they are moving in that direction. They will soon reach the levels that we're seeing here in Canada. But Canada is further along what I would say the secularization trend than you would find in the United States. We're not as far as what you find in Western Europe, in Great Britain, but we're not as far behind as you will in the United States. We're somewhere in between, and that's the general direction that we're moving. Now, what are the implications for the local church is not just in thinking missionally of how do we reach young people, but it also has to think about institutional and organizational sustainability. If you have fewer young people who are identifying and or attending religious services, it also means that you have a smaller pool to draw from when you think about succession plans for leadership within a denomination and a congregation. And so we have to think carefully here as well of what does this mean for how we think about the denomination and for a local congregation when it comes to leadership succession. How do we raise up young leaders knowing that there's a smaller pool to draw from when we think about the long-term viability and sustainability? This is one of many differences between Canada and the United States. The United States, just by its sheer size, has a much larger pool to draw from. It is shrinking, but the pool is much larger to begin with than you have in Canada. I always listen with different conversations about the state of ministry and ministry training within Canada. I'm a sociologist first and foremost, but I teach in a theological educational setting such as Ambrose. And on one hand, I hear conversations and concerns from different denominations, different settings about what is Ambrose doing for the local church in training young people into ministry, vocational leadership, etc., etc. And on one hand, a place like Ambrose and others need to own that. We have a significant responsibility in this respect. On the other hand, part of the partnership I would suggest is that it's in the hands of local churches and denominations to be tapping people on the shoulders as 13, 14, 15, 16, 17-year-olds to be asking, does God have a call in your life into this kind of vocational ministry? Knowing that there's a smaller pool, and by tapping people on the shoulder, and by getting people to think in this particular direction, it leads into a place like Ambrose. We can only work with those who come, right? Well, we all understand that, but we'll work very hard to work to form and equip and push strong leaders for this denomination and others for the broader church within our country. And so thinking strategically about how the local church and denomination and an educational institution like this can partner with the many gifts and opportunities, mindful that we have a smaller pool to draw on. Recent book that came out, I've included in your handouts a suggested reading list. You don't have to read all these things. I've read a lot more. I've condensed it for you, so then if you have an interest, you can look at these. But it's a book that just came out a few months ago titled A Culture of Faith, and it looks at evangelical congregations in Canada. It's the first study of its kind conducted by Sam Reimer out at Crandall University in Moncton and Mike Wilkinson at Trinity Western University. Excellent book. Strongly encourage you to take a look at that. One of the things that they document there is that pastors in evangelical settings are concerned about the next crop of young leaders coming up within the church. With all of the common stereotypes that people have about young people today, feeling entitled to this, that, or the next thing, of not necessarily thinking holistically, theologically, or even having a strong theological base, roots, etc. So even within existing church leadership, there are concerns about the training and development of the next group of young leaders within our context. So all of that is part of the background to say, as a church, as a denomination, as a congregation, how do we tap people on the shoulders and equip and train them for thinking about potential leadership within the church, both in the short and long term. And so I'll say some more things later on about that, but this sets some of the empirical context for thinking about such things. Now, there is a, I would say, growing sentiment within sociology of religion that if we were to describe young people and their approach to religion generally speaking, it could be captured within this phrase, moralistic therapeutic deism. I'm going to show you a video clip. It's about 6-7 minutes long that captures this from the authors of this book, Soul Searching, The Religious and Spiritual Lives of American Teenagers, that I think will cast the net fairly accurately for how a number of young people view religion. I'm not saying you have to agree with this interpretation, but I would suggest that this is, in fact, how young people view the world and religion. And so if we want to engage young people, it's important that we understand how is it that they actually view the world on these significant matters. This gives you, in a nutshell, the theology of young people. They want to be happy. Religion is intended to help them be happy. Religion is intended to help them be moral people. Therapeutic. It's just supposed to help me when I have a problem. And this sense that God is this butler that just shows up. Now, where do they get that from? Where do they learn those narratives about God and theology? Is it in the music we sing? The ways in which we interact within our congregational settings? Is it from other outside influences, etc.? It's probably a combination of all of these kinds of things. But I would want to think very carefully, what are the what are the theological messages and cues? What is most important about this faith? And are we clear, consistent, and concise in that theological message that we communicate? If a young person boils it down to, God wants me to be happy and get married and stay a virgin, is that the essence of our theological scope of Christianity? What is the essence of the things that we communicate? So I just throw those out as questions to think about. Laced within all of this is this narrative of individualism that pervades all of modern Western society, but rears itself among young people when it comes to choice. You saw this in the clip. They want to have choice. They don't want anyone to tell them what they ought to think. They want to decide for themselves. It's about identity. Identity is very important, and religion may come in or go out of that identity, but that is an anchoring point for young people. They think very much in a relativistic fashion, and they think very subjectively. At the end of the day, I'm going to decide what is true for me. I'm not going to focus on this today, though I talk about it in the book. Most adults who attend church on a Sunday morning are increasingly moving in this direction as well. It is not uncommon for a young person, for any adult who's sitting in the pew to hear what the pastor says and to compare what the pastor just says with what they already believe to be true. And if there's a disjunction between the two, more often than not, the person will lean to their own authority rather than the pastor's authority. Now, we can unpack whether that's good, bad, right, or wrong, but the point is that increasingly people are subjectively appropriating theology however they view, so much so that they might diverge from official church teachings, however defined. So this is part of the reality, and young people, I would say, are picking that up within the overall cultural milieu that they find themselves in. When you ask young people who and what are important in their life, and how that shapes their worldview and where religion or spirituality factors into this, we have some interesting findings. This comes from Reginald Bibby's book, Emerging Millennials, in 2009. He asked a whole series of questions to young people across the country, and he finds these things out. And when you ask young people what are the most important things in life, here they're ranked. Of those who mentioned the particular item the most often, 86% of young people indicate that friends are very important in their life, followed by freedom, comfortable life. If we go much further down this list, you find spirituality and religious group involvement as important to them. If you want to have an indicator, again, of where the church will be, you look to your young people today, and what we're finding is that spirituality and or church involvement does not rank very high. If we're thinking about our programming, the ways in which we engage families within our churches, etc., how do we address this kind of reality where religion and faith and group involvement does not figure significantly into those things that are important? Later on, I'll offer some insights on how I think we might respond to that. But clearly, religion and spirituality is not important for young people relative to other things that are significantly more important. What concerns young people most? Doing well at school and what they will do after school. This is not that surprising, given the ongoing pressure for education within society today and to get a job and the fear that is encouraged in all aspects of social life, that if you don't have an education, you will not get a job, or you will not get this, this, or this. So that is number one on the minds in terms of the fears for young people. Now, who do you turn to most with your serious concerns? This might surprise some. Family, 35%, friends, 31%, friends and family, they'll turn to both of them, 7%, and God, 2%. Two observations here. First, you'll notice that God is right at the bottom. Again, reiterating this point that it doesn't figure prominently into a young person's worldview. Second, is that family is actually the number one thing. You might assume that friends would be number one. Family continues to be a strong influencer over a young person and how they view the world. Yes, they may rebel, they may act out, they may do all kinds of things that seek to distance themselves from their parents or siblings, etc. But family continues to be very important. One simple, trivial kind of example. You're 15 years old, you have your first boyfriend or girlfriend. One of the things that's important for you is to introduce that person to mom or dad and get their opinion or thought. Why? Because this is something that's very important to the 15-year-old, and if they can get the approval of mom or dad, then this gives kind of an official rubber stamp of the most significant people within their life who have given their blessing of sorts. When they have concerns, whether it's about school or other kinds of things, family and parents continue to be a significant source for children and teenagers to turn to as a way of processing and resolving that. Thinking once more practically and theologically, how might the church engage families and equip families to help journey alongside their own children in processing the concerns that they confront within society? And there are many of them. We won't go through them today. But parents are an important part of that discussion. Much research is coming out these days about the transition from teenage life into young adult life, and specifically on the impact that those transitions have on their faith development and how they think about faith. So here are two books, again, referenced in your reading list. One, After the Baby Boomers, the second, Souls in Transition. Here are a series of realities that young people face in these transitions. First, delayed marriage. You might have got married at 20 or 21 or 22 a generation ago. Now people are getting married on average between the ages of 27 to 30. What impact does that have for local churches? We know, and I would challenge this, I do so pretty strongly in my book, that we know that getting married and or having children can be a catalyst for people to turn to the church. If the gap from when you once were attending, let's say junior high or high school, you stop attending, if that gap is lengthened 5-10 years until you potentially return, the likelihood of one returning decreases. And so if people are getting married later in life, what impact does that have? Well, the hypothesis here is that people are less likely to turn back to faith-based groups. I would concur that the likelihood of people turning to religious groups for weddings, for example, and then maintaining involvement is reduced the longer that gap is. Second, people are having fewer children and they're having them later in life. We know that children has, historically speaking, been a catalyst for people to pursue religious involvement or to maintain religious involvement or to increase their religious involvement. Again, if that gap is diminished, if that gap is extended, the likelihood of them returning is less likely. You have uncertainties over work and money. Earlier we saw education as a primary concern. This is connected to what will I do with my life? How will I earn money? You see all kinds of studies and reports today that show that before the age of 30, young people will work in 10, 15, 20 different career settings or venues before they actually settle down. When people walk out the doors of any university in Canada today, it is more and more likely that they still have no clue what they want to be when they grow up and what they want to do with that education. They've just kind of gone through the system, if you will, because that's what they've been told or socialized, that's what they should do. But they don't have a clue of what they want to do. So these kinds of concerns become paramount, especially with rising debt connected to tuition, the stereotypical script, get an education, get married, buy a house, have children, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So these kinds of concerns are on people's minds. Higher education, we've talked about that. Loosening relationships. This ongoing quest for community amidst transitory times. We know that it's more difficult to maintain relationships, even though we have social media and Facebook, etc., the more that you move physically from one place to the next. The fact that people as children and teenagers are moving more frequently, often due to employment reasons with parents, they move for universities, all those transitions break another chain within that long flow of connectedness to a religious group and to a local congregation. This is one of the common catalysts for people to diminish levels of religious involvement when they go through a transition of this kind. Social ties, I argue, one of the two guiding conclusions in this book, social ties are one of the lead explanations for higher and lower levels of religious involvement, whether you have them or don't have them inside of a religious group. So these kinds of transitions can make it more and more challenging for young people in those transitions. Globalization, the fact that we are sensitized and aware of all kinds of information instantly, raises all kinds of information and doubts and awareness for us that can contribute to doubt within one's own faith tradition. The fact that 5, 6, 7-year-olds are well aware of who and what ISIS is, are keenly aware of the religious diversity all around them within their own school setting, as well as what's going on around the world. If you look at classic secularization theory in the sociology of religion, it will say that the greater degree of religious pluralism that you have in a country or in a nation, the more difficult it is to maintain religious belief or practice within that context. Now this transcends national boundaries, because with globalization, technology, social media, at the click of a finger, we're aware of all these different perspectives that suddenly makes us aware that what I learned in the Church of the Nazarene isn't the only way of viewing the world. And it's not just that of Christianity relative to Muslims or Buddhists or those who say they have no religion, but it's different than what Catholics or Baptists or Lutherans, etc., might think. So these kinds of things create some challenges for how people think about that transition. Culture and technology, and then last, family. Family, not just in the transitory times of moving, but also the greater social acceptance towards things like divorce, blended families, etc., that also are a transition that can have a corrosive effect for young people and their faith development and their ongoing connectedness to a faith community. If we were to summarize all of these transitions, one might say that most, if not all of these, have to do with what sociologists call, quote-unquote, this world concerns. They are the immediate, tangible things that we are confronting in day-to-day life. That what it means for religion, which is, broadly speaking, conceptualized as an other world concern, something that transcends the immediate, particularly if you don't believe that God is overly active within the world at large. If we're increasingly concerned with this worldly kinds of things, religion and faith takes a back seat, because it's not really going to help me find a job or solve my relationships or think about these kinds of transitions that are going on within the world at large. You can agree, disagree, etc., with those things, but if I'm serving a local church, I want to ask myself, how do these transitions positively or negatively affect young people within our congregation? And how might we pay attention to these transitions and, importantly, step in and try to help with these transitions so that they are not corrosive for a person's faith development? How might we help, for example, people who are transitioning from high school to university age? So in our own local church here in Calgary, we just had a large cohort of students who have graduated high school and who are going to different universities here in Calgary. How do we maintain the level of collegiality that they have with each other over the last 6 years, for example, in junior high and high school, into their young adult years, rather than just letting them dissipate and fragment into all kinds of directions? How might we be of service to them within our local church and help create an environment for them to help within those transitions? Because it has implications for when they get married, when they have children, and these kinds of things. All right, final overarching set of sociological observations and then some practical and theological insights. What happens in the home is the greatest predictor of how religious or irreligious a person will be later on in life. This may or may not bring you comfort in the local church, but on one hand, what I'm saying is it doesn't really matter what you do in the church. If it's not happening in the home, it's not going to carry as much weight of what you're trying to do. Point being, we need to think, how do we equip and partner parents in the very serious task when it comes to religious socialization within the home? Because we can offer all these kinds of programs and do all these kinds of things, but if it's not being reinforced in the home, the likelihood of that carrying on in that child's life or teen's life long term is significantly reduced. And you can look at all kinds of areas of social life where that's true, whether it's areas of education, drugs and alcohol, religious involvement, participation, economic views, et cetera, that have implications there. So a few insights from different studies show that young people are more prone to maintain their faith when their parents are actively involved in the religious group. That is, mom and dad aren't just dropping Johnny off at Sunday school, but they're actually attending church as well. When young people are actively involved in their religious group and they maintain personal religious practices, they're more likely to maintain those things into their adult years. In other words, if they're not attending church as a 13, 14, or 15-year-old, or they're not practicing various religious and spiritual disciplines as a 14, 15, 16-year-old, the likelihood of them suddenly taking those up later on in life are significantly reduced. When they have good relationships with older mentors who are religious, they're more likely to maintain religiosity into their adult years. And when they're given responsibilities in their religious group, and I'll give some specific suggestions later on in that respect as well, they're more likely to maintain religiosity. So we know all these things, but we also know fewer and fewer parents are raising their children in the ways of any particular religious belief system. When I look at this study that I finished part of this book project, one of the almost surprising themes to me was how many parents are increasingly taking what I would call a hands-off approach to religious socialization. Rather than specifically introducing them to certain religious beliefs or practices, they're saying, we're going to just let our child decide what they want to be and what they want to do. It's a very Canadian approach, a very nice thing. We don't want to offend our children, because really parents have less and less control in the parent-child relationship these days. And so this is an extension of that that says, we want our child to decide, therefore, either A, we'll never bring them to church unless they ask, and what child is just going to randomly ask, can I go to church, if they're not exposed to a social environment like that? Or they might bring them to their teenage years and then give them the choice. And you find more and more saying, you know, when my child's 12 or 13, they'll give them the choice, and unsurprisingly, teens are probably going to take that choice and not attend religious services. And so here I see this comparison between two groups in my sample. Those who are, say, over the age of 55, they recall when they were raised never being given that choice. It was basically, Johnny, Susie, get your pants on, get outside, and we're all going to church. The conversation now is, Johnny, Susie, would you like to go to church, or would you rather play video games, or sleep in, or play with your friends, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Now, there are pros and cons to either of these. I'm not just saying that we should force children and teenagers to attend religious services. There are certain contexts where that might be appropriate, or other things that need to be at play. But understand that if choice is given and or a hands-off approach is endorsed, the likelihood of someone taking on faith later on in life is much less than if people are even forced to attend as children or teenagers. The residue of that, of those who will stick around, is going to be greater than the residue of those who are having a complete hands-off approach to attending later on in life. So there are many complexities within that. There is the chance, and we see this, it's well documented, I do so in this book, that people will rebel against that as well. And we need to caution and think very carefully about how we think about parenting with children in those settings too. But I would suggest that the choice, the hands-off approach that parents are taking, is potentially more problematic for the long-term sustainability for faith organizations and for individual person's faith in the long term than actually forcing one to go, so to speak. Now, there are a few things that we know about coercion, rebellion, dialogue, and retention that I want to suggest. Coercion, rebellion, definitely a possibility. Well documented. No doubt you know people within your own sphere for whom this has been the case. These things are buffered against when dialogue occurs within the home and within the church amidst our encouragement for people to attend. So we see that when parent-child relationships are grounded in dialogue about religious matters, as opposed to a top-down authoritative parent-child relationship, that this is helpful to buffer against the possibility that teens and young adults will rebel against their parents' faith. Moreover, when children have a good relationship with their parents, there's all kinds of literature within sociology of family that talks about different parenting styles and strategies. Research consistently shows that you need to have this sense of being firm, of having boundaries, but also having overt love that's expressed for your child on an ongoing basis. In other words, you can't just have a permissive love all the time, but you can't have an ongoing firm set of boundaries without love that's actually communicated and expressed to the child. When you bring these two things together, you ground it in the sense of dialogue. It contributes to retention, either in children sticking around in the short term or potentially returning after a hiatus. The prodigal son narrative in this context, because that ongoing dialogue continues with one's child, even though they've left the faith for a period of time, however long that is, the fact that you still can dialogue about that with your child can go a long way to whether they may return. It doesn't mean they automatically will return, but it increases the chances of them returning if that kind of context is present within those settings. All right, last slide, and then happy to open it up for conversation, dialogue, feedback, and so forth. What does this actually mean practically and theologically for churches and denominations? I would say first and foremost, as an overarching heading, that it's important to do things with excellence. You have to be relevant and engaging with young people. Your music has to engage with them. Your preaching has to engage with them. There has to be a setting for relationships to be fostered in relevant and meaningful ways, etc. However, and I cannot stress this strongly enough, this will not just attract people to your church. This attractional model that's been repeated time and time again in all kinds of settings is not true. It's not accurate. It is one of the strongest points that I argue for in this book. People may stay if you have good music, relevant preaching, programming, etc. But people are not just going to suddenly come out of the woodworks because they hear you have good music or your preaching is relevant and engaging. So my point here is do things with excellence. If for no other reason, it's going to help you to retain those who you already have within your midst. If we aren't willing to create some flexibility relative to our music, our preaching style, the ways in which we do things, and I'll give different examples below, at what cost are we unwilling to attend to those kinds of things? Thinking both in the short and long-term health and sustainability of not just the individual congregation, but the denomination as a whole. So we need to do all these things, but this is not the silver bullet that will resolve things. This is a retention kind of thing to pay attention to. I would say there are two overarching things that are of value. One is things pertinent to parents. The second has to do with churches themselves. First, parents need to model, instruct, and dialogue on matters of faith if that is going to help in passing on the faith from one generation to the next. That is, parents need to practice what they preach. If they believe church attendance is important, they actually have to attend church. If they believe that reading scripture or praying or fasting or whatever it is, serving at a homeless shelter is important, then they actually need to do those things. Children will not take up these behaviors and practices if their parents are not also modeling those things within the home. So how do we encourage our parents to model the very things that we believe are important behaviors for children to adopt when it comes to faith formation? Second, parents need to instruct, to teach and instruct children on religious values, attitudes, and behaviors. It's not enough just to take Johnny and Susie to church or to pray or to read scripture, but to also explain why this is important. So we're bringing them along the conversation of this is why we think it's important to participate in this particular ritual or behavior or experience, and to instruct and include them in that, which is connected to the third point of dialogue, of keeping dialogue open, of asking questions, and welcoming discussion. I speak with a variety of denominations across the country. And I pick up different tips and things that they're doing in different contexts. One of the churches that I spoke at, they do, in their bulletin, they have a little piece called At Home. And so they have a couple of questions that are intended to follow up from either their Sunday morning sermon or from the Sunday school teachings that week. And they encourage families to talk with their children around these two or three questions at some point during the week, whether it's over a meal or setting aside some dedicated time to do that. What they're trying to do is encourage parents to dialogue with their children. Children have many questions these days. 5, 6, 7-year-olds are coming home and they're keenly aware that there's a mom and a dad and a dad. They want to dialogue because, as we saw in the video, increasingly young people reject the traditional orthodox conservative views on issues of sexuality, for example. I'm not here to argue about the theological merits on these points, but we need to create a space for our children to be able to debate and dialogue, as opposed to just saying, no, that's the wrong belief, now discard it. Even if you believe it's not the correct belief, it's the process of actually landing somewhere. So can we encourage our parents to dialogue with their children about a myriad of issues towards their faith development? If we don't, then the chances of them leaving is significantly increased because they don't feel like this is a safe place and space to talk about this. And they're going to talk somewhere. So if they're not getting it within the home, they're going to get it in all these other sources that, theologically speaking, could raise some problems and concerns within that setting.
Would you prefer to ask a question later?
No, that's fine. Yeah, no, go ahead.
Something that's coming to my mind immediately, Joel, as you're talking about this, is that how many of our parents themselves are uncomfortable with this process because of the instability in their own faith journey, right?
Yep.
So for instance, for parents to sit down, I love what you've said here about dialogue. We have to create space for the pushback and for not lashing out at our kids, but talking through and helping them understand why they feel the way they do, why the biblical position is what it is, whatever it issue it is, right? But what's coming to mind is that how do this cannot happen and will not happen if our adults in the church are not healthy, mature Christians themselves rooted in Scripture, right? If their own lives are not actively being developed into Christ-likeness, and if they don't have the kind of knowledge and maturity to do this, in my mind, I'm looking, going, this breaks down. Yep. So maybe, I don't know if you're going to talk about this a bit, but it seems to me that we can't just go, okay, we've got to put all our attention on getting parents to do this with their kids and their teens. So many of them are probably not doing it right now because they don't know how.
Yeah.
Because there's a disconnect between adults and faith.
Yeah.
I'm kind of thinking out loud here. Can you talk about that a little bit? I mean, how do we begin to address the adult issue as we're trying to address this, you know, pass on this faith to our kids and our teens?
Yeah, absolutely. Great question about how do we equip parents when there's a deficiency there, when we're trying to encourage them to equip their own children. Let me jump to the bottom point to address that in response, and I'll say two things. I would say a recurring theme as I dialogue with different denominations across the country is this question of adult discipleship. How do we disciple people who are new to the faith, all the way to those who have been around the block a few times, but still who have opportunity to grow and develop and mature? I think this is one of the perennial questions for churches today, rightly so, and is something that deserves great attention of adult education when it comes to theological beliefs and values, and the practical theology side of that as well. What does that mean in a very real practical context for how I think about my family, my employment setting, my finances, and so forth? So I would say, on one hand, the church has a job, and I don't think the church is missing this. I think this is just a complex matter. The church needs to give significant attention to how do we disciple people, adults specifically, within our church, to strengthen their faith and to push them, to call them out, to meet them where they're at, all these kinds of roles along that continuum. I think there's a place for doing that. And part of that has to do with reminding parents of the role of religious socialization. That is, parents typically say, here's my child church, now sort them out, give them good morals, teach them the Ten Commandments, et cetera, et cetera. And sometimes churches will resist that and say, actually, this is your child, so here you go, it's actually your job. It's a both and. So how do we bring these two together so that we can help equip parents? Because you're right, they don't know how. Parents are not born parents. You learn to become parents by trial and error and all kinds of things. And in the domain of faith development, we have to help equip parents in that respect. So what are the kinds of resources we're providing for them? I'll say, I spoke with a church last year, and they invited me in for a weekend, and they asked if they could do a Friday night session with parents. And, I mean, I do, if that's what they want to do, that's fine. I was kind of leery heading in. I didn't know if there'd be much uptake. Do parents really want to come hear a sociologist of religion talk about these kinds of things? And I was shocked that 75 parents showed up, which spoke to me that there actually is a desire for parents for these kinds of things. And so are there resources that we're providing parents within our local churches, et cetera, for these kinds of things? And I'm not talking just about this kind of stuff. They want to know about stuff on just practical parenting kinds of things through a theological and Christian perspective, whatever that is. So how do we equip them and provide them some resources? Maybe it's providing different social media outlets. So my sense in just listening on the ground is that you have parents, generally speaking, mothers who are actively involved in social media, Facebook, etc., who are gathering all kinds of information on how can I best parent my child. Are there opportunities as a local church that we can provide, have you watched this video? Have you checked out this book? Have you read this article? Which means, as church leaders, we need to be engaged in these things. We need to be attuned to what is out there, filter through, and try to pass on helpful resources that are meaningful for those within our local context. So I think discipleship for adults, first and foremost. What does it mean to be a godly parent, a godly follower of Christ, etc.? And then second, providing some tangible resources for our parents to help in socializing their own children and to give them some demonstrations, to give them some examples of what that actually looks like, just to talk about in practical terms. So some may say, you know what, I mean, you might even, on a Sunday morning, you may have a panel of four different sets of parents in your church. Tell me, how did you raise your children? Well, you know, when they were 3 years old, we did this, and when they were five, we packed shoeboxes for Samaritan's Purse, and we went and served at the Mustard Seed downtown, or we prayed with them before they went to bed every night, or we would read this story and we would talk about it, or whatever it is. But just things that you might take for granted as quote-unquote simple ideas might be very new and novel to many in the congregation. So can we help to mobilize and create those kinds of opportunities for them to get some practical insights as well? Yeah, that would probably be my answer to that, rightly or wrongly. And I'm not a parent, by the way. I just study these things. So the first thing you learn as someone who's not a parent is never to provide parents with advice on how to parent. You never parent someone else's child. It always seems easier from the outside. So this is a purely academic response. So you can think through, for those of you who are parents, of what that really looks like on the ground and those that you interact with. But I think there's much sociological data that would suggest that there's some valuable insights to come out of that. So we begin with parents, great emphasis there, but there are things that churches need to do coming alongside, remembering that parents remain the central focal point. Take faith seriously with young people. Do not trivialize it. We've documented different examples of things that they know about the world relative to religion and faith. So let's provide age-appropriate instruction for sure, but let's not trivialize the questions that they have as 7-year-olds, 10-year-olds, 13-year-olds, and so forth. And let's try to take those at face value for what they are and try to navigate, whether it's in our minds faulty theology or not, how do we engage those and take them seriously at the point that they are at. Community is significant. We know this. Young people are looking for community. Creating space for children and youth to find community and to flourish is a significant asset for young people to remain within the church entering their young adult years. Do we create that space and venue for them to do that? Mentorship is also of value. That young people desire cross-generational relationships, importantly, with people who are not their parents. I'll give you some practical examples. This is probably the biggest thing that I'm trying to encourage people to think about on this issue of passing the faith from one generation to the next. And it is intergenerational ministry within local church context. In our own church, we've been trying to think about this question and many others. One of our five core values is intergenerational ministry, which means that in most or all of our different ministry outlets, we seek opportunities for the different generations to converge together, to rub shoulders with each other, and to have opportunities for mentorship, formal and informal, to happen across those generations. So we do some different things. If I think about, I'm a drummer, so play on some Sunday mornings. And if I think about the composition of those who are part of leading music, we have, we'll have a 10 or 11 year old who's singing, to a 15 or 16 year old playing bass or electric guitar, to myself, a 34 year old on drums, to a 65 year old playing another instrument. For us, this is intentional. And we think about all of our different groups who are leading, because I have an opportunity playing drums to chat with a 15-year-old bass player, right? We gather on a Saturday night for a practice. Our task is to create good, strong music, et cetera, et cetera. But a sidebar, or not, is that I'm here to mentor that 15-year-old and to hear about how his week's going. Or to think about the 10-year-old who probably doesn't have a really clear conception of this whole God thing and Christianity thing, but as they're singing songs and as we're engaging in conversation when we go to Tim Hortons or McDonald's or whatever before or after practice, that this 10-year-old is rubbing shoulders with someone else who's not their parent, but who can speak words of life and truth and wisdom into their life. Example two. We do different outreach things through our local church. We have, in many circumstances, our teens who organize these events, but they're church-wide initiatives. So we go and serve at a senior's lodge or senior center, and our 15, 16, and 17-year-olds are coordinating everything. But as a church, we come together. We give a sense of ownership and leadership to our 15-year-olds, and yet, as a whole group, we come together and we do these things. We have what we call intergenerational services, which is not the same as a children's service, to be clear. Intergenerational means it crosses in both directions. And so we'll have 75-year-olds to 10-year-olds giving different readings and prayers. We'll have, in any ordinary service, our 8 or 9-year-olds who are collecting the offering as part of, for them, a very meaningful thing that they feel like they're contributing, etc. So you could think of different examples. But these opportunities for intergenerational ministry provides a venue for that cross-pollination and mentorship to emerge, sometimes naturally, sometimes you kind of will that into existence by creating those settings and venues for mentorship to happen within those contexts. This goes back to the point that I raised earlier of young people in our church, the smaller group of young people who are attending church regularly, are we tapping them on the shoulders to think about vocational ministry in the short and long term? It requires those of us in the adult age range to be attentive to that and consciously pursuing that to mentor people within our church settings. Equipping for ownership and leadership, young people desire to own and lead things. And it gives them a sense of purpose, a sense of community, and a sense of meaning. And as they invest in those things, they invest in others, and people invest in them. I'm sure we could all give examples of our own growing up years where we either were or were not given opportunities, and how that played a significant role in how we view the things that we do relative to our faith. As a teenager, as a drummer, I played in a band. We did rock shows and all these kinds of things, and they let our group lead worship on a Sunday morning. Now, it was probably theologically suspect, I'm sure, the song. We should think carefully about the music we sing. There's a lot of theologically suspect songs that we sing and shouldn't sing. It was probably very loud, etc., etc., but the opportunity they gave us for a sense of leadership and ownership was profound in my own faith development. Or we had peer-led small groups. 16-year-old leading a small group, these kinds of things. Now, we could discuss the merits of whether that's good or bad. Think about, you have to provide the right environment. But the point is that having ownership and leadership is significant. Related to that is the desire to serve. We hear the big buzz of social justice and young people want to serve, etc. Creating venues for that to happen. I gave the example of our young people who organize some of these events within our context. All these things give a sense that I matter and belong here within the local church context. Young people are not the church of tomorrow, right? They're the church of today. We all are part of the church of yesterday, today, and tomorrow. So we all have to contribute to that in a very real and meaningful sense if we want to see the 15-year-old in our church when they're 35 and when they're 55 and their children and their children's children and so forth. Incidentally, serving others is one of the best catalysts for community in local churches. We've often thought about being a small group and that's the catalyst for community. That might be true for some. For many, it's not. But for some, it is. But serving, gathering around a common task and all the informal interactions that you have as you're driving down to the mustard seed and you're serving food together and then you gather together afterwards are also significant catalysts for community. Experiential opportunities. This came out in Reimer and Wilkinson's recent book, A Culture of Faith. They talked about opportunities for camping ministries and mission trips of some kind are notable experiences for young people and their long-term faith development. We have to think carefully about that. There are also limitations. If they have these big highs and then they don't come back to any kind of infrastructure that helps to foster and nurture that, where they cultivate this sense that we just live from one high to the next. But in principle, these things are incredibly valuable, and so we see that in the literature. Dialogue, when it comes to young people, this will be my final story, and then we'll open it up. Creating space for young people to dialogue within a church setting. One of the things that we've started to do in our church over the last year and a bit is to create a space for people to dialogue within the Sunday morning service. As opposed to the standard stand and deliver kind of presentation of the scripture, though that is valuable and has its place, we understand that we all learn differently. We all receive and interpret things differently. A lot of people want to actually dialogue and engage with that. And so we've, in some settings, have shortened the sermon time, and we've created a space for an open question and answer, manifested in two ways. One has been the actual verbal question and answer, though we're very aware that in a larger setting, not as many people are as comfortable with that, particularly young people. So we've also incorporated option B, and that is for people to text in their questions. And as someone who's moderated most of those conversations, inside of 2 minutes, we'll have 25 to 30 texts, questions based on the scripture they've just heard and very significant and serious kinds of questions that they're processing. And a lot of those are coming from young people. This can be a risky venture and maybe not appropriate in all social contexts and settings. Don't just leave here and do everything Thiessen said in your local church. Listen carefully to your own context and say, might this work, might this not work? But in our context, it worked quite well, and young people in particular. And what it did is it engaged them in the dialogue, where they heard this scriptural passage where Jesus says, I am the way, the truth, and the life, and no one shall come to the Father except through me. And the 15-year-old asks, does this mean that my friend who's a fill-in-the-blank will not go to heaven? Or why not? Or why do bad things happen to good people? All these classic kinds of questions. But it says to them that this is a safe place for you to ask questions, and importantly, for us to answer and dialogue about those things right on the spot with you, because we believe that's important. It's a slightly different paradigm, I understand, for thinking about a Sunday morning, but it does tap into even the larger adult population who I think we see also want space for dialogue. It can be risky for sure. It creates the unknown because we don't know what they'll ask and trying to answer that on the spot, which is why I believe strongly in strong theological education so that you can think on the spot and answer those things and think holistically and so forth. But trying to think about how do we facilitate dialogue with young people, and then equipping parents, which I mentioned last. Churches that do these kinds of things are known to be far more vibrant and stable long-term. The good news is evangelical churches, of which the Church of the Nazarene is a part of, are historically some of the most successful groups who do these kinds of things. So these could be opportunities to enhance, build, modify, etc., to strengthen those kinds of resources. So, with that said, we have a little bit of time left. I'm happy to answer questions, feedback, thoughts, etc. during the time that remains.
How often do you do the Q&A as a part of your service? Sunday?
No, we don't have a set ritual or pattern that it's X number of Sundays we do it. So it's been a bit sporadic. In some series we've done it every week over a 6-week time frame. Other times we've done it maybe every 6-week kind of thing. So, and there are congregations who do this every week. That's a part of their local context, and there's others who will sporadically do it as well. So my advice is be in touch with your local context of what would or wouldn't work. Try it once. It may be a big bust. It may not. The only way to know is to try, and then discern thereafter of whether that's a good way of proceeding. Maybe texting works, but the verbal Q&A doesn't work, or maybe it's the other way around. Maybe it's splitting into small groups and having some discussion. Maybe that doesn't work. So be very, very cognizant of the people who are part of your congregation and what that looks like. Any final thoughts? Question. I know it's a lot to chew on, information overload, all those kinds of things.
Do you have a separate children's component in any of your morning services, or is it always intergenerational?
We do have a weekly separate children's component. So we have our, I mean, as with most churches, our time together, some of the singing, etc., and then children are dismissed halfway through. They do a dedicated children's thing. The children come to the front, do a little story, etc., etc., and then they have their sort of age-specific thing. But then on months where there are 5 Sundays, the 5th Sunday on any of those months, we have this intergenerational service where the kids are part of the entire service. And then the service is designed in such a way. And we had lots of interactive things. I think it's actually good. I originally was thinking of becoming a youth pastor, and then I soon realized that wasn't for me. but when I was learning tips and tricks on being an effective youth pastor, they said, if you can tell stories to children, then you'll be a great youth pastor, and I would say even senior pastor, because you need to be able to tell stories. And so one of the things we've done in these intergenerational services is had interactive exercises with our children. So there was the one in the Lenten series leading through the Passover. We actually had what a Passover meal would look like. And here's the different things that they had, the bitter herbs. And so the children would try them and wouldn't like them. And they would try all these different things. But it was an interactive, hands-on experience. We had all these tables set up at the front. And the children would go through those things. The children will disperse things, hand things out to the congregation. So they had hot cross buns, right? And so they would just walk around and hand them out to everyone. We'd explain the meaning and significance. So trying to think creative, whereby they are involved in some ways, but those tangible things help them to remember. But no, it's not part of every single service. We have a bit of both.
Do